You are listening to the Horse Radio Network, part of the Equine Network family.
Welcome to the Dressage Today podcast. Today, Aviva and I are catching up on what's been going on in everybody's life because, as we know, life moves at the speed of sound. And we had a really amazing interview with Mark Langley. Now, most of you probably have not heard of Mark Langley. One, he's from Down Under. So that's really cool. We got to listen to his accent. But two,
which was really Mark, nice.
it was a lovely accent. Yes, it was.
Yes.
Two, we brought in a natural horsemanship specialist. So we wanted to talk to somebody a little bit outside the box to see what he thought were some of the things that dressage people could do to help their horses more. So good morning, Aviva.
Good morning. So what's new with you? You've been traveling all over the place. Are you home for a little while or are you on the road again?
It was a 3-clinic month last month. I was in Colorado. I was in Montana. And then I got back from Montana and I hosted Mark here at the facility. Our farm way out in the middle of nowhere is an international clinic destination, which just makes me laugh. And now I am getting ready to go to Maui tomorrow. And then I don't have to travel for a little bit. I'm kind of excited. I'm actually going to, of course, I'm waiting till it's brutally hot in Florida, but I'm going to show my horse this summer.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah, that's
so
the plan.
Exciting.
I'm going to get him out at fourth level and put together a freestyle.
The lessons are going well? The lessons are going well with Kathy?
When I get the lessons in with Kathy, they are going well. Mark gave me some really good pieces. It is shocking to me when I listen to these different, you know, high level people. Mark was saying something about pressure and I'm like, oh, that's the same thing Mary was trying to get me to do. Oh, when he had me do that, that's the same thing Kathy's trying to get me to do. So it's just, I find it fascinating to connect all these dots. Mm-hmm. And I just keep getting better and better. And I also keep riding my horse in the cow pasture. So, oh, I have 2 new bottle cows.
Oh, how fun.
I do. Brownie was the first one to come in. And because he's black, but he's sunburnt. So he looks like that crinkly top that you get on a brownie when you cook him.
Oh, how cute.
We were uncertain if he came in with or without nuts. So I figured Brownie was a good name.
Okay.
And then a couple days later, actually, while Mark was here, Mark and my husband, Chris, were out in the cow pasture perusing things and they found this other orphan. And so Mark and Chris wrangled said orphan and brought him in and he looks identical to Brownie.
Oh, wow.
So I named him Fudge.
Oh, how cute. How do they end up orphaned?
Different reasons. Sometimes the mom dries up. You know, cows do expire at some point because they're, you know, they get to a certain age. And sometimes they have an illness that prevents them from continuing to mom.
Okay.
So, you know, different reasons.
Okay.
Brownie's mom had cancer. She was still nursing him, but they were both very poor.
Yeah.
So he was actually easy to get him on the bottle. He transferred over really well. Fudge, his mom expired out in the pasture.
Oh.
And so he was not as easy to get on the bottle, but they are out with my other 3 little girls and they are exploring their little tiny cow world and they have grasped the concept that I am mom and they come to the bottle. So it's all going really well, and I'm just keeping my fingers crossed for while I'm gone.
I was going to say, who's going to feed them while you're in Maui?
Well, you know, it's not – I have a new girl working for me, and she's doing a great job, and it's really not hard to get people to feed baby cows. All of the ladies that were here for the Mark Langley Clinic, they were all like, do you need help feeding the baby cows? And I was like, yes, as a matter of fact, I do. So that went really well.
Oh, that's so fun.
So what's going on with you?
Well, fingers crossed. I think I might have a buyer for Ralphie. And it sounds like it's somebody who is going to love him and cherish him and keep him forever, which is what I want for him.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to say any more. We'll just see how things go.
Yep. 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 We will be thinking positive thoughts in that direction for Ralphie.
I appreciate that.
Very cool.
So very cool. Moving on, though.
Moving on.
Moving. Yes, there we go. I got a really, really good Ask the L question from Alex. And okay. I want to answer this one because I think it's a very interesting conversation provoking question. And I'm going to say what I think is my answer, but I would love if our listeners would like to chime in at some point, either, you know, posting on your social media or my social media or some way letting us know what they think, because I think this is a really interesting question. So the question is, I've always wondered if judges do or are supposed to take into consideration a horse's conformation or breeding when judging. I mean, a long-backed horse will find the work harder, and maybe his top effort is only ever going to look like half the effort of a horse with conformation that makes things easier. Is the effort the horse and rider are making in spite of their physical shortcomings ever a consideration?
Wow.
Isn't that a great question?
Yeah.
So
what's the answer?
So in my opinion, and this is my opinion, basically the answer is no. Basically... Oh. Sorry, that was my phone going off. I guess I won.
That was perfect timing.
Yeah, that was good. I'm turning off sound now. Sorry about that, everybody. That was funny. Basically, my answer is no. Dressage is like every other sport. It is supposed to be an objective thing. We have movements that we need to do. We have expectations of how the movements are done. And the better a horse moves, the higher the score is going to be. If you are a basketball player and you're 4'11", you are not going to be the same quality basketball player as somebody who is 7'3".
Mm-hmm.
You know, the playing field is not level. End of discussion.
I was actually thinking, you know, about Spud Webb, the basketball player from, I don't know, early 2000s or something, because I think he's only 5'7", and he did not get extra points when he made a basket,
you know,
just because he's short.
He's the anomaly, right? He is the anomaly. Right. But think about what we see at the Olympics. Think about how many horse rider combinations actually make it to the Olympics. So my short answer is, you know, what you buy is what you bought. And if you bought a six mover, you bought a six mover. And the fact that you couldn't afford a nine mover, I understand. You know, if you bought a downhill quarter horse, that was a choice that you made. If you bought an uphill tense thoroughbred, that's what you bought. So when you come into the arena, you are presenting saying, this is my horse and this is my training. So the short answer was no. The long answer is, a horse that has difficulty doing things is going to take longer to develop than a horse that finds things easy. That makes sense, right?
Sure.
You're probably not going to go into the ring if things are too difficult for your horse, because that's not fair to your horse to try to make it do something that it's not strong enough or ready to do.
Right.
On the other hand, judges are riders. And one of the things that we look for, it was interesting, I just sat in on a clinic with Lilo Four, and she talked a lot about effort. And I loved hearing her say that. Did the horse make an effort? Did the rider make an effort? So there are movements that your horse needs to do in a test that are judged on a basically as flat a scale as we can make it. I expect every horse to be able to do it at this level, you know, this way. And either you do it really well and you get an 8, or you do it really poorly and you get a 4. Or you do it, you know, satisfactorily and you get a 6. but there are certain things that are expected. On the other hand, there are bonus points that you can get for movements that don't require quality of movement, shall we say. So a halt. Any horse can do a phenomenal halt.
Mm-hmm.
Any horse can do a turn on the haunches.
Mm-hmm.
Any horse can do a nice leg yield. Transitions are another thing that you can get bonus points on if you do them well. And you can have a horse that, you know, I have seen horses, I've judged horses, and my comment is struggles. And that's not a comment that I like to make. Right. On the other hand, I have seen horses and my comment has been clear effort. Now, a clear effort may not be that they do it particularly well, but I see that they are trying.
Mm-hmm.
And that effort score, you may see reflected in the collective marks under submission. You may see the effort score under the rider or the effect of the aids, because well-ridden, not well put together or not particularly great moving horse can be so honest and so correct without being extravagant. And so they may only be getting sixes or 6.5s throughout the body of the test, but in the collectives, they're getting an 8 on submission because they're making that effort.
Yes.
So the short answer is whatever you bring into the ring, that's what I'm going to judge. And everybody is judged on the same scale.
Mm-hmm.
And I judge horses that are 8 and 9 movers, and I judge horses that can barely get their legs out of their way, and they're barely 5.5 movers. Mm-hmm. And I have to judge them the same way.
Sure.
Because that's what this sport is. On the other hand, and we've talked about this a lot, I see people who come into my ring with incredible moving horses ridden poorly. And they're getting scores at the very lower levels because the horses are just moving so well that you can't not give them certain scores.
Right.
But I also see horses that come in who really aren't particularly good movers, but they're doing the things and they're trying and they're willing and they're honest. And those efforts are going to be rewarded. They're probably not going to get an 80.
Right.
Because unfortunately, the gait score does impact every movement to some degree. But a correctly trained average moving horse can easily beat an extravagant, poorly ridden horse.
Yeah.
So, you know, there are horses that I look at. For instance, there are certain horses that come into my ring. Like when I was going through the L program, one of the horses that we judged together was a Friesian. And the person that was teaching us just kept talking about she loved the uphill balance of this horse, and it was a training level test. Mm-hmm. And I said, I agree that the horse is very uphill. That's his confirmation. That's his breeding. Mm-hmm. What concerned me was that the horse was tight over the top line and very closed in the throat latch. And at training level, we want a horse that is more freely coming over the back.
Mm-hmm.
And how do we do that? And what she said was, that's a very good point. I think we need to look at both things. So sometimes the confirmation does give you an advantage. Sometimes it gives you a disadvantage. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the quality of the movement gives you an advantage. And sometimes it gives you a disadvantage. And I know sometimes if you will come into the ring and you've got a lovely horse and it's inconsistent in the connection, you're going to get dinged more than a less extravagant moving horse that's inconsistent in the connection, because the judge might expect more.
Yeah.
So I think that we try not to make those things make a difference, but I think to some small degree that they do. But at the end of the day, do you love your horse? Are you proud of your training? And is your horse making the effort?
And when you said earlier, you know, you might buy a six mover, I thought about that and I thought, what if you're only a six rider?
Yeah.
And I don't mean that, you know, I always want to think when I'm teaching in a clinic, this person's doing the best they can.
Absolutely.
And if you are a six rider and despite your best efforts, you're only going to be a six rider, maybe on a good day, you're going to be a six and a half. Do you buy an eight mover hoping that it's
and dumb it down
for it?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Because then are they really going to be an eight mover? And at what point does the judge go, you need to improve your riding to match your horse?
Yeah. I have said to riders, you are a better rider than your horse is a mover. And you got 100% out of what your horse can do. This was a stunning ride. And the score might not necessarily reflect it because, again, it's an average moving horse, but the rider did such an outstanding job.
Yes.
Of, you know, showing off what this horse could do and showing off the correctness of the training.
Yes.
You know, and at the end of the day, as you said, some people are six riders. Some of us are less than that. Some of us are more than that. But at the end of the day, we all go into the ring and we do the absolute best we can. None of us wake up in the morning and say, I'm going to abuse my horse. I'm going to yank on his face. I'm going to gouge him with spurs. I'm going to do terrible things. Sometimes our emotions get out of the way. You know, we understand that. But everybody is doing the best they can at that moment. And you know what? If you're doing the best you can, then your horse is probably also doing that. I mean, I remember saying to my trainer, Cheryl, one day about Tiger, how frustrating he is because, you know, he's this well-trained horse. And if I'm not 100% on and really doing everything right, neither does he. And she looked at me and she said, well, if you're not giving him 100%, why would you expect him to give 100%? And, you know, it's such a simple but such a profound statement.
Yes.
So if you go into the ring and you stop riding and your horse stops performing, whose fault is that?
Mm-hmm.
But if you go in the ring and you give 100% and your horse gives his 100%, I can promise you the judge is going to see that. And that effort is going to be rewarded in some way, even if it's only in the further remarks.
Yeah. And that's the thing. I think we get so attached to the score that we miss the comments and the improvement of the comments from previous tests. So again, if you know you're riding a six mover and you're barely breaking 60%, but you could be like, oh, I barely broke 60%. This is so disappointing. But look at your comments and see them say, you know, good geometry.
Clear effort. Yeah.
Yes. 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 Well-ridden circle.
Wasn't it Lendon Gray who said you can win by being accurate? You know, she rode, granted, you know, her horses were not, quote, ordinary, but they certainly weren't Vallegro. And she would go out and get fabulous scores and beat people because if the transition was at A, her transition was at A. And if the line went from K to X, her line went from K to X.
K to X, yep. Yep,
you know,
absolutely.
I mean, she was the mistress of accuracy. And if you have a six moving horse and you can't get the extravagant, you know, gait scores and all the rest of it, be accurate because you're going to make, you know, the geometry police of Eva really happy.
I had a kid that had a quarter horse when she was in high school and they were... So he was a very average moving horse, but the harmony between them and the accuracy, they were a joy to watch and they nailed it at training level. She got into the 70s on more than one occasion. Mm-hmm. And when we moved her up to first level, I said, you have to understand that your scores are not going to stay that high. And it was very, because he just didn't have a lengthening. And it was really hard for her to understand that, because she didn't at the time understand she was only riding a 6 horse, and she'd been bringing him to such beautiful heights.
Yes.
Because of their harmony, and the yes. effort was seen between the two of them. So yeah, it's, yeah, be with your horse. You know, this is, as you said, this is the horse that you picked. The horse didn't get to pick you. And if this is your best effort with your horse on that day, I say, hoorah.
Yeah. Honor what you have.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and at the end of the day, the majority of us are not competing to go to the Olympics and don't want to. The majority of us are doing the best we can every day. And while we're mm-hmm. out at competitions because we want to compete and win, mm-hmm. we're really not competing with other horses. We're competing with ourselves. Mm-hmm. And if you can, you know, if your goal today is, I'm going to have a straight center line, and your center line is straight, then you won.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because 100%. You know, it's hard. Dressage is hard. Oh, I judged this weekend two different shows, and ooh. You know, it was so funny because I kept talking about circles are hard. Mm-hmm. You know, where you start the circle and where the circle is supposed to be placed in the arena, and making it the right shape and the right size with consistent bend and consistent tempo and consistent frame is really yeah. hard. And it's hard yes. at intro.
Yes.
And it's hard at Grand Prix.
Yes.
You know, it's yes. hard. This is a
choose
tough
your
sport.
Heart.
Yeah, yeah, this is a tough sport. So
I think that anyway. That was not only educational, it was inspiring.
Well, thank you. And I'm interested to hear what our listeners think. So feel free to contact us and let us know what you think about this.
Send us some feedback.
Yes. And excellent. Maybe we'll address that in our next podcast. We'll just have to see.
Cool. Well, and remember, alrighty. If you like what we're doing, remember to hit the like button, share us all across all of your social media outlets. And now we're going to have a word from our sponsor.
From short training tips to how-to videos and insider access to private clinics and lessons, learn from top dressage experts with Equestrian Plus. Watch exclusive interviews and lectures, slow motion demonstrations, and step-by-step tutorials taught by top-level pros, and explore cross-discipline topics such as groundwork, rider fitness, and stable management. Visit equestrianplus.com to sign up for a 7-day free trial with subscription.
Thanks for coming to the Dressage Today podcast. I am sitting in the flesh with Mark Langley of Mark Langley Horsemanship. And Aviva is, of course, far, far away in Maryland, which makes us sad, but at least we get to join each other here.
Thanks for joining us, Mark. I'm excited to talk to you.
Oh, thanks, Steffi and Aviva. It's a pleasure to be here. And yeah, it's really great. And to be over in the States and help people out, it's really exciting. So, and yeah, I really appreciate you guys welcoming me on the podcast.
Yeah, you're a little bit out of our norm, but people are starting to recognize that we're not the norm. And we like to give people a different viewpoints.
Hey, speak for yourself, Stephanie. I'm the norm.
You are the standard, Aviva. There's a difference.
I don't think so. Well, you know, I think the most important thing here is, you know, Mark, you are a little bit out of the norm for us. So why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, how you came to be who you are and what you are, what your philosophies are, your training, and, you know, we'll interrupt you nonstop to ask questions, but, you know, start to tell us about yourself and how you think you can help our listeners.
Yeah, no, thank you. I think it's interesting because when you say out of the norm, maybe in the dressage world, sometimes in the horsemanship world, I feel out of the norm because I do a lot of clinics and even the horsemanship people turn sideways and go, that makes a lot of sense. How come I didn't do that years ago when I was learning my, you know, doing my horsemanship, you know, stuff? So, so yeah, I think in a lot of different disciplines, people look a bit sideways, but then the results at the end of the clinic and that they can feel it and see it in their horses and themselves. So, but yeah, how I got to where I was, you know, when I was a kid growing up on horses and they were just a tool of trade, I never thought I'd be sort of going around helping so many horses and this would be what I'd be doing. I started taking on horses sort of professionally in my sort of mid 20s after I'd sort of, you know, I'd been to the States, I'd saw some horsemanship stuff, I'd got some big ideas and I sort of went home clueless to go and start horses. And I'd grown up in a horse, like doing a lot of horse tracking. I'd worked on like cattle properties or stations in Australia and different things. And but I think the biggest thing that really sort of kicked me to get me going was I just started taking on horses to start and educate. And I'd met Jenny, who's my wife now, and she sort of would love every critter on the planet. She's got a massive heart for any animal out there, and she's a bit of a conservationist. And so she. There's something in her that I guess sort of was like symbiotic that went into me, and I saw animals differently as well, and that was one thing that sort of I believe helped me as well, because when you grow up and your whole life and the people around you, they're just like a tool. You don't really get, you know, that you just operate them, and I know you guys have probably met people out there in every discipline that they just get on and they just. They may as well want to buy a motorbike because they're not really interested in how their horse is feeling or how soft they are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, but I, when I started taking on horses professionally, I was still training them, but then I started to get horses that had been through the ringer, like they were wouldn't matter if they were ex-show jumpers, race horses, whatever that someone had acquired, or so they sent them to me when basically everything else failed sometimes. And when you see a trouble in a horse that's been through the ringer, you suddenly change your whole perspective on things, and you actually feel kind of I guess that's when the empathy in me really kind of that's when I did start to have a lot more empathy, because I went, wow, what have people done to you to get you to here, and how can we shift. How can I shift my training? At that time, I wasn't teaching, but how can I shift my training so horses don't get to here? And how can I figure out how I can help horses that have already hit rock bottom climb back out and become soft horses in the world again that can still cope, I guess, in the mosh pit that they're going to be thrown into, because the mosh pit let them down somewhere. So basically, I guess that really grew my heart, and from there I did everything in my power to sort of figure out a way that I can educate horses, just become a lot better at understanding everything, but without sort of taking away their ability to cope and self-regulate. So, you know, what I mean by that is, you know, we can take up all the slack ourselves by becoming a guru, but if our horse doesn't become a guru, then what's the point? So, you know, so it's about trying to align education that the horse can still cope traveling 4 hours in a trailer, or, you know, going to dressage competition and actually being able to process that whole environment and not have all that extra external anxiety kind of influence them in a negative way. So then by the end of the competition, their kind of eyes are hanging out of their head and they're ready to go home. So, yeah, so from there, and you know, I got better at understanding those horses. I'd done a lot of wild horses, you know, unhandled horses, because in Australia, you know, I put my first ad in the paper and then all these horses got jumped off trucks, and 15 lessons I had. So, you know, there was no kind of here's my sort of nice rugged horse to start. So when you get wild horses jumped off trucks, you know, I say wild as some of them might have been wild Brumbies, some of them might have been just horses that were just – like sometimes they just breed them and then they put them in the bush and then they think about time to run them in and break them in. So you get those horses, and I really sort of had a steep learning curve, you know, quite fast, but it gave me the chance to really sink or swim, because in 15 lessons you had to have that horse going, you know, and I know that sounds like a short amount of time, and I wouldn't encourage anyone to do that, but it was when, you know, that's what you did and that's what you had to do, because, you know, people weren't going to spend a lot of money, you know, with, you know, mm-hmm. leaving a horse with you for sort of all these weeks. And yeah, it got me really to think fast and try and work out effective training. And everything I'd learned when I came overseas to the watch a bit of horsemanship stuff, a lot of it I threw away, and I had to kind of figure out, well, no, this is not working. This is, I'm going backwards to fix my own mistakes. How can I not make those mistakes? And yeah, and then slowly, you know, the training that I do has evolved, and there was little moments, pivotal moments along the way. I think that, you know, I read a simple book, and there's a trainer in America who's written some really nice books. I've never met him personally, but there were some old books of when he was growing up. They're more story books, and the message I got out of one of those books, and that was a Mark Rashid book, was we're here to help. And that was the day I said, I can't make this horse do this. I have to step back and analyze, how can I help this horse move forward? It's not about me. It's about, how can I help the horse? And now every student that comes to me and say, well, stand back and say, how can you help this horse? Or how can you, at that stage, it was, how can I help that situation? Not, mm-hmm. you know, how can I help that situation that just happened not happen again, so that horse feels good through its education? And then there was a message that came through that was, if you push your horse away, they'll soon know where you want them. And from there, I started to really think about how we can not push our horses, because if you've had a look yourselves into the horsemanship world and just any, doesn't matter if you're hacking or you're doing show or dressage, a lot of people revert to just pushing a horse away from pressure to motivate it. And from then I really started to think about, you know, how can we use pressure to, you know, create a pathway for a horse, not just a something that the horse is trying to, you know, escape from in some form. And the old message from the old horsemanship masters was, follow a feel, not move away from a feel. So I think there's a real clear message in just in those words alone, is what do you want to create? A horse that follows a feel, or just moves away from pressure, or moves away from a feel. So yeah, so moving forward from all that, I just kept evolving. And then I met another fellow who fence sat when I first started doing clinics at one of my clinics.
Fence sitting is auditing. They call it fence.
Okay.
They don't sit on fences anymore, but it's still cool. So, yeah, and he'd worked with an American trainer, and his name's Ross Jacobs, and he worked with an American trainer for quite a few years, who more of a clinician called Harry Whitney, and he was talking about the you know, directing the horse's thought, and he was also talking about rein management that was a little bit different to what I'd sort of grown up seeing. And I started thinking about it, so I cut my legs off for a while on horses and tried to learn about the reins. And then through a few old posts here and there in classical dressage, I heard these little kind of stories and snippets of about rein management that wasn't what I was seeing in the sort of competitive realm. So, and I was quite fascinated. But when you're getting sent horses all the time and you've got no one looking over your shoulder, well, you can sit and practice all you like and figure things out. So I fiddled away with that, and I found some real key things that I think was missing in a lot of disciplines, and even horsemanship. And that was part of the message that actually helped the horse go towards their thoughts and create better balance and softness and trusting pressure. And those messages, you know, from Ross and Harry were still, you've got to keep your horse feeling good all the time, but you're still empowering them to cope with pressure and all the life situations they're going to get thrown into. And then I guess I did more clinics, and when I had to sit on a chair for the first time and watch someone, and they were paying me what I thought was good money, and it was like any money at the time was good because we were sort of pedaling so fast backwards, we felt that we had to do a clinic here and there, because you know it was one of those things that was sink or swim. And maybe we didn't set the we were I was getting set horses all the time, but we still weren't. You know, so I thought I'd do a weekend clinic and to try and help keep the wolves from the door. And then the first day I had to watch someone and try and give them advice, and everyone wanted advice. I looked hard at every situation, every movement the person made, every movement and thought the horse had. And then I actually realized there's more things I probably knew that I didn't know I knew, but then my learning from teaching actually grew so much more because of the being able to explain and analyze and watch how horses operate with different people and things like that. And yeah, so now
I know I know a lot of dog trainers talk about the fact that training the dogs are the easy part. It's training the people that's more difficult. Do you find that with your students as well, that the horses tell you what to do, it's harder to deal with the people?
Yeah, the hardest thing I think, you know, is the people have to be on the right page in their mind to process that information, and learning is a very uncomfortable experience for some people. Their egos are either going to cut me off because I'm telling them the opposite of what they've been told. But when they start to wriggle in their chair, they start to, they're learning, or they're going to walk out, one or the other. And that's I think when people don't take it on board and they smile and say yes, but really they're just going to go home and go back to their old habit, that's when it's quite hard. And that's when it's quite hard to shift the person. When they go, wow, this is the opportunity that I've always been looking for to help my horse, and they embrace it, then you've got that window, and then it's easy to mold them. But it's still hard because they've got ingrained habits, they've got anxieties from other areas of their life that are infiltrating their clarity and stuff like that, and their stability. And I think really it's you have to understand and see that and try and shift that in little pieces. But it's their understanding of the horse's mind and the brace in their horses too that you really got to, you know, break through and get them to really look at and see. Once they see it, they can't unsee it. That's the amazing thing about it, is when you show someone something or you say, see that eye there, and see how that horse hardens through its whole body, and they said, oh, yeah, they've probably always been doing that, haven't they? I said, yeah, but see him let it go just there. And they go, oh, now I can achieve that, can I? Yes, you can. And once they get a few little achievements, the ball starts to, you know, roll, and
I think a lot of this, watching him teach the different people over this weekend and working with him with both my more advanced horses and my baby horses, there are things that Mark has said throughout the clinic that I went, that's the same thing that Kathy Connolly said to me. I'm just getting it from a different direction. Or, you know, he's got me doing the same thing in my body that Mary wanted me to do, but he's coming at it from another different avenue. So it's been fascinating for me watching the different changes in the different horses and the people, and thinking how all of this really does tie together to, if the horses feel better about themselves, if they feel better about the clarity that we're giving them, they go with us better. And it doesn't matter if we're going down the trail or around a test or around a course of fences. And that's what it fascinates me watching the changes.
Well, Mark, you said something about, you know, pressure and, you know, using pressure in a constructive way. Can you talk a little bit about what that means? Because I know when I was growing up in horses, it was, you know, make the horse more afraid of you than they are of whatever it is they're afraid of, which we now, that's not what we do. But pressure is still sounds like such a negative kind of concept. And I don't think you're intending it negatively.
No, not at all. The hardest thing, and, you know, I battle with is there's this kind of rift out there of, you know, should I go negative reinforcement? Should I go positive reinforcement? What should I do? I've done a bad job at negative reinforcement, so I go to positive reinforcement, but now my horse has issues from positive reinforcement, but you never really mastered negative reinforcement, so you're in a conundrum. So, and in science, like I was talking to someone who was doing some studies in horsemanship again, because their science was starting to come back and look at what trainers are doing, and I was having a discussion with her, and I said that the thing is, you know, the base model of negative reinforcement is what, you know, what we read in words is, and we've all learnt this and heard this as horses learn through the release of pressure. And, you know, you've heard it, Aviva, Stephanie's heard it, I've heard it, everyone that's come to one of my clinics think that I reward the horse through release. And it's correct. I'm not saying it's incorrect, but it's not black and white just like that, because otherwise, because I see a lot of horses trained in horsemanship and negative reinforcement that are hunting the release all the time, and they become release hunters. And once they become a release hunter, they never become a feel follower unless someone else comes in and says, no, you have to be comfortable with this pressure so you can follow it like a leading hand. And I come across release hunters all the time because people believe that throwing the reins away, releasing the pressure, is how a horse feels better. And if you think that creating release on a horse is going to make it feel better, then the only thing you can do to a horse to make it feel better is release. That means you can't actually actively help it when it's in trouble through pressure, because release is what they're hunting.
That makes sense to me.
That does.
And I think about that in a dressage test, like it would almost, if we were releasing the pressure, we would be doing more of the test in like a stretchy circle method, as opposed to in a training level frame or a third level frame. If that was an applicable situation, we'd be doing that, but it's not, because we do have to pick the reins back up and reapply the pressure.
Maybe pressure isn't the right word. Maybe collaboration or direction.
I believe pressure is an okay word. Here's something to think about. Like, I'll use some scientific words that are used in when they just do the basis model of, you know, horse learning. I'm just trying to think of which one I'm trying to work out. So when a horse does something that and undesirable that you don't want it to do, they call it, what is it, positive punishment. Yeah, there's positive reinforcement, negative reinforcement, and positive punishment. Now, punishment is a terrible word to use. To me, it sounds horrible, you know, that I would punish a horse for doing something wrong. So if a horse, say for instance, an example of positive punishment, it might be the horse, you know, doesn't want to go in the trailer, so you do a series of kind of things outside that make it feel uncomfortable until it wants to go in the trailer. That would be an example of positive punishment. The horse is not wanting to go in the trailer. And it's also an example of, probably positive punishment is more that the horse does something wrong and then you do something to make it difficult, and they call it positive punishment. So an example, I would rather call it positive pressure. So if a horse sort of walks off and you're holding a rope, the horse will take up the slack in that rope and find the end of the rope. Mm-hmm. So the horse did something that you didn't want it to do. It walked off and left. It kind of walks up, takes up the slack, and then it feels that end of the rope, which is for pressure. You're just holding the rope neutral. You might just step back to create a little bounce in it so the horse recognizes there's a boundary. But I don't think that is punishment. I actually just think that's the horse found a boundary and it realized that where the path of least resistance is. And to sort of call it positive punishment makes it sound brutal. Like if a positive punishment would be the horse walks away, so you go and whip it for walking away.
Okay, is this an example of pressure? You want to go from walk to trot. You put an aid on and the horse says, oh, you want canter. And he tries to canter off and your hand closes. Yep. To say, no, I just wanted trot.
Yep. So that would be positive pressure opposed to positive punishment. Punishment would be, I guess, if your horse goes to go to canter and then you start banging its mouth and saying, you don't do that again, and running it backwards. You know, so you'd actually actively use your aids to do something to make the horse feel very uncomfortable, opposed to making a pressure that says, well, just let that go.
So it's also different at different points of the horse's life. Was it, like, if somebody's trying to teach a horse to do a flying change and they do one when you weren't necessarily asking for it, you wouldn't punish the horse for that, because it's, at least they're searching.
They're searching and they're trying, and you're just creating boundaries and certain resistances. And, you know, like the way I'd like to think of the reins or anything is the horse is following the path of least resistance. The path of least resistance, not necessarily hunting release, you know. So, and I think that's the key in following a feel or trusting pressure. But the biggest thing that I think, like, that happens though is it's very easy to micromanage. So the biggest thing is when you do close the reins or do guide a horse, you're waiting for that emotional change and the thought change, because if the horse is thinking forward still or it's rushing into that transition, maybe mm-hmm. its thoughts are 100 metres away and that's the only reason why it's rushing, or maybe it's a little bit frightened of the legs or something like that, or not understanding the legs. But whatever you do, whatever pressure you apply, has to make a change so the horse comes back into that realm and its thoughts are back there to restart again.
So this might, I'm thinking of this in a half halt situation. You know, that's a big fancy dressage word. And I'm thinking about it like if you were judging a test of Eva and you're judging a second level test and somebody's mm-hmm. made a really good collected to medium trot transition, but then the downward transition, like the horse went out of balance.
Yep.
Somewhere on that long, on that diagonal line.
Mm-hmm.
And when they tried to come back to the collected trot, there was just there's a whole pileup of horse in their hand because the balance was lost. Therefore, you had to use more pressure to get them back to where you needed them to be.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the line in the sand would be you're bringing your horse back and you're holding the brace and the tension of the horse wanting to push forward, or you're creating enough feel and pressure to say let go of that so you can sort of offer a little bit more release so the horse can find that space with you and soften in that space.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just applying enough pressure to get the horse to make that real change instead of containing the horse and then, which is only just going to micromanage and contain the brace and the anxiety in the horse.
Mm.
So, you know, the half halt, like in my mind, it wouldn't matter if you sort of, you know, you blinked an eye or moved your hip or whatever. Half halt would only be, are you listening?
Right.
You know, so mm-hmm. right. It could be just the lift of a rein. Like I when I ride, like if I was going to, like, you know, I don't really call it a half hold because I just go, you know, I pick up a rein and say, you know, say for instance, I just do something which is a little adjustment to say, you know, we're coming up to this corner. I noticed you're getting a bit of a strong thought. Can I interrupt you just to say, are you ready for this next movement? Or am I going to let you get to that corner and go around the movement still thinking somewhere else?
Mm.
And I think you're just getting that horse to come back and be ready for the next thing. And if you can train your horses, you know, that you can interrupt them very easily if they do have a little bit of a mistake, because horses are going to get distracted all the time. You know, the softer they get, the more focused they get, and the less of all those outside interruptions that we can't control are going to influence our horse's stability. But what happens when you train, and this is what I'm trying to encourage, like some of the horses at the last clinic, they had such strong focuses on outside things that you couldn't interrupt them. And I see a lot of dressage horses with their ears forward ploughing into the bit. But if the owner just recognised the horse's thoughts are so far ahead that that's why it's ploughing, they've got to get that horse more interruptible. And I think it doesn't matter what you're doing, it's that being, can you interrupt your horse softly or do you always have to shout to interrupt it? And I think that's where the half halt and preparing a horse is, how much have you practiced interrupting your horse so it comes back softly and says, I'm here.
So when we look at top riders like a Carl Hester or Stephen Peters, they're very good at checking in with their horses and having a lot of micro interruptions to say, are you here? We're doing something. Are you here? We're doing something.
Yep.
So, yeah. See, I told you, it's all kind of the same.
Mm-hmm. Well, I watched a Spanish rider at Equitana. I might have been Portuguese. Anyway, if I'm wrong, and there was things I quite agreed with, and it was more so when I watched him ride. I think what I disagreed with is his version of softening the horse before the lesson was really, really good, and the horses got soft. But every one of those horses did a can of pirouette, and the horse that came in hot went the best when he was preparing the horse and bringing it into a good mindset to do the next level. But when it did the next level, it left the arena just as cooked as it came in, because he was going to get that done regardless if the horse was ready in that environment or not.
Mm.
But what I was watching, the difference, because I watched the riders ride the dressage movements and then I watched him ride the dressage movements, and the biggest clear difference that I saw, because I learned from watching him more than what he was saying. So when he rode, I noticed the horses weren't coming into the bridle nice and just softening and starting to collect and just use themselves a bit better. What I noticed when the owner was riding that horse doing the same thing, they were trying to hold the horse and push it into the reins and get it to sort of, you know, come together. When he got on and did the same thing, you saw him close the reins clear enough for that horse to actually slow down and reset a little, and then you'd see him loosen up and let that horse find that space in his hands. And it was clear as, you know, crystal that when he closed the reins, he got a change. Now, he mightn't be talking about a thought in the horse, but he did get a change where that horse actually listened, came back, reset, and then they could go back into riding forward into contact again where the others were just kind of holding and holding and not getting a proper change.
Timing and feel.
Mm.
I like the concept of being able to interrupt the horse to get it to refocus. Are there some things you said, you know, you could do a little lift of the rein or you can move your hip, or are there exercises on the ground that people can do to help their horses sort of be interruptible, come back into focus? Are there exercises under saddle that you find, or is it very individual to the horse and the rider?
Well, there's so many areas in interruption, so which hole do you want me to go down first? I'm going to give you two braces that I talk about a lot, and I think it's necessary for all the people who take their horses out to different shows and stuff to understand both of these braces. The first brace I'm going to talk about, and I don't want to confuse the listeners too much, is eye brace. And so basically when you ride a horse, some horses are so overwhelmed with the stimulant around them that they get interrupted very easily by things, and then when they're interrupted from something that they've seen, I call it eye brace because their eyes are just putting all this brace in their body. Now, the problem with eye brace is a lot of times we use safe, and I can use it in both contexts of on the ground or under saddle. The problem with eye brace is someone picks up a rope and says, hey, stop pushing, and or they might be riding and the horse gets an eye brace. So the horse stares at something and gets fixated by it, or whatever that fixation causes. It could cause a whole bunch of things. I won't go too far into the what it does. And then the person goes, I'm going to have to use the reins and really get this horse to wrestle it around this corner or whatever like that. And I say, so when I work with people first, I work out how much eye brace their horse has before they even think about using the reins or the rope to get the horse to let go of the other brace. So the other brace is when I pick up a rein or I pick up a lead rope, the horse just leans against it because it doesn't understand it. So basically, if I'm working at interrupting a horse on the ground, the horse might sort of stare off and I might just do something that catches its eye and says, hey, stop being influenced by all these things that are causing you to brace from what you're seeing. So you say, let go of that. So you might bang your leg, do something, interrupt them, and they learn to be interruptible. So basically we won't get them to get rid of that sort of fixation on all these things that are around them straight away, but by interrupting it and then leaving them for a bit and then interrupting it, they become more interruptible. So you're opening up like a neuro pathway that they actually start to. And what I've seen so many times is once you can break that fixation, they will start to do it themselves. So I'll give you an example. I had a horse that was staring off into the distance looking at a black cow on a hill, and someone might say, well, can you let it stare that till it kind of gets over it? And I was like, well, not while it's doing that, because it's just fixated and it's not processing. It's just in a full state of freeze. So I worked a bit hard to interrupt that one, and then I interrupted it, and then it blinked a bit and it sniffed me and it went, oh, I'm here again, am I? Oh, I was on another planet. And then I said to it, I just got the rope and I said, now look back over there. And it looked, it processed the cow and said, yeah, I've done that now, and came back and said, now what do you want? So basically by interrupting it and showing it that that was available, horses learn to start to see something and then come off it a lot easier. And that's essential in any horse that you take anywhere. And you see a lot of horses running over their owners, you know, leading from one place to another at a competition, because the eyes are just everywhere and they don't even notice the person in front of them. So sometimes it might be just eye braces when the horse doesn't notice you. So you got to get up and do something that visually stimulates it to say, oh, you're just there, are you? Sorry, I didn't see you. Whereas some people just bang them on the nose all the time for being pushy. Whereas I've got to say, no, their eyes are just looking through you over the top of you. You have to interrupt their eyes. And so they see you again. That's eye braced. And you're just getting them to let go of that fixation or that hard thought. When it comes to rein brace and pressure brace, like lead rope brace or anything like that, a great example is a backup. Like, you know, my horse is riding up the arena and it feels like it's pushing off like a train. Well, do I have to close the reins until the horse actually thinks back to me? But some people thinking back to them is not quite enough because that horse has always been a bit of a plow. So basically, you might have to close the reins enough and teach that horse to back up, because a backup is such a good tool from bringing a forward thought back. Because when a horse truly backs up, and this is the difference between a fake backup and a true backup, is a true backup, the horse is actually thinking backwards and you see their ears processing like rearview mirrors. They're looking in the rearview mirrors like you're backing a trailer, mm-hmm. and you'll see them, their eyes will roll back a bit and they'll back up. So by teaching a very good backup in all your young horses or even the old horses that learn to brace, you've actually got a very good tool to stay, stop thinking forwards, reset, let's try again. And a lot of horses, I had a horse once in an arena and I think I backed it a long way, and it was a cob horse, a gypsy cob horse. And the owner said, why did you back it so far? I said, because I couldn't reward it backing with a forward thought, because this horse is shutting everything out and I had to wait till it thought back and reset. And then by doing that, then every time you hold a rein, the horse knows it has to commit to that rein to change its thought. And the biggest area is people just don't commit long enough, so the horse is still hanging on to the worry. And why is that thought change so important? If you're worried about something, you're going to keep worrying about it, so the worry cup just keeps escalating all the time or getting fuller.
Did that answer your question?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm processing it. I'm thinking about.
No, isn't it amazing?
Yeah, yeah. So Mark, I'm thinking about horses that the reaction is not to freeze and stare, but the reaction is to retreat, to spin, to bolt, to go someplace other than where the whatever it is that's gotten, you know, to do the opposite of focus, to focus on get away.
Okay. So the horses that retreat are pushed. So this is where people have to really think about their training, and the Carl Hessners of the world don't get there from sitting on the couch. And
yeah,
this is the problem I have. If people want this horse and they want me to wave a magic wand, and I'm like, well, I can kind of try my hardest to do a bit of Harry Potter on your horse, but at the end of the day, you've got to be a wizard. You know, you can't be a muggle.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I'm saying is I'm trying to teach them to use a wand and have a bit of wizardry, but wizardry is disciplined, isn't it?
Yeah.
And so most horses I get that spook, they're already in enemy territory and their mind's on safety back at the barn or back at where they were near a safe place or a horse or whatever that they've sort of hooked onto. And when we push horses like wheelbarrows, okay, I'll give an example, okay? I'll give it as an example a horse that's – this is what I do with a horse that would generally destinate back home. And you say you're talking about a horse that spooks. Well, a horse that's thinking back home and doesn't have a lot of confidence is going to see everything out there as a threat. And if it doesn't – and in the past, if it hasn't had enough processing time to analyze, retreat a little bit, come back, then basically it thinks that we're going to throw it over a cliff, so then everything becomes more of a threat. So – and I know the owners that are riding these horses, they don't necessarily think they're trying to throw their horse over the cliff, but you've got to be in your horse's head. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they're actually seeing the different thing. Like I've said to people, you know, someone said my horse is excited jumping, and I said your horse is terrified jumping, and they're like, oh no, it's excited. Look, I go, I'd change your word. So basically, going back, so a horse can process environmental stimulant and things like that that are going to potentially spook it. We maybe have to go back and say, okay, at what point does the horse tell us it's nervous in this environment, and what have we done to help it? And that's where approach and retreat comes in to training our horses. So I get on a lot of performance horses who have performed and they've got all these buttons, but I can't even drop the reins and get them to walk a straight line. And I'm like, So this horse has been ridden in a straight line by you riding crooked all its life, or, you know, at what point can we just drop the reins and let that horse go straight? I said, because this horse is bouncing off everything in this arena and it's been kind of held up by legs and band-aids to keep this horse in a straight line, because every fence, every little thing's kind of pushing against it. So basically, if that horse is getting pushed through the valley of death like that, as soon as something big happens, well, it's just a coiled spring ready to recoil back to where it felt safe.
Right.
And I'll give everyone a real tangible example, I suppose, of how I'd either train a young horse or retrain a horse that feels like a coiled spring and everything's going to kill it, is I drop the reins and I ask it to go and I see where it takes me, and it takes me exactly back to where it felt safe. And then I might go towards where it's safe and I might pick up a rein and say, yeah, but that's not available. And then I'll sit on it again and squeeze it. And then it'll look a bit like tacking. You know how when you're sailing, if anyone knows about sailing, what they do in sailing when the wind's going towards them, they angle the sails to tack across the wind.
Diagonal. Yeah.
So what ends up happening, the horse is always pulling back to safety. And then I'll just turn it and I'll tack, and then the horse will bounce back to safety, and then I'll tack. And then all of a sudden it might look out in the direction that it was frightened, and then I'll just wait on it and say, we have a look, that's all right. And then after so many rides at tacking, the horse actually takes me out. So my aim with young horses or older horses that have started to sort of become overwhelmed by the environment, or they've got a very strong destination like home that they want to be going back to. Some people over here call it barn sour. It's just a separation anxiety, but separation anxiety is only caused by anxiety, just like the person at work who has a really crap day and everyone's kind of hammering them. All they want to go home is just to go home and sit on the couch and read their book. They didn't want to be at home when the day was good, but they want to be home when it's bad. So a lot of separation anxiety is only caused by the anxiety that's already in the horse that's causing it to seek safety, because that's what their master's of. They get a fright and they want to be safe. That's horses how they've survived and evolved over the years. And I think if we understand that psychology in horses, that they only seek safety, we can make a lot of progress with them, because we can offer them that safety in every situation if we play our cards right. So what I'm sort of trying to say is that horse can fold back to home, and we allow it to go back a little bit, but then we just say, because by going away from an object or back towards home a little bit, you've actually given that horse a little bit of safety, saying, I can get you to retreat a little bit from that, and there's a place you can go so you don't have to be forced up to it. And then you turn back, and eventually their curiosity starts to come out, because they know that there's room behind them that they're allowed to go to retreat if they need to. And then slowly but surely they get more curious and they go into the valley of death and all the scary things out there, and they actually go, I can deal with this, because if I need to step back a step, I can. Now, you might say to me, well, that's no good in a dressage test. I might say, well, I wouldn't do a dressage test on a horse that didn't know how to walk through the valley of death.
That's a very, you know, very good point.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and a lot of people are taking their worried horses to tests, and they don't have the confidence, nor do they have the understanding of the reins and all the other things to survive that. And it's like, if you're going to go to Afghanistan, you've got to know how to shoot straight. You know, going there in a pair of undies and a water pistol is not going to make you feel any better.
Yeah.
It's been a very entertaining clinic. Listen,
I'm sure.
Okay.
Well, I'm just
have to get him on a plane here real quick. So do you have any other questions? I'm sure our listeners have tons of questions, but.
Oh, so many questions, but not if he has to get on a plane. But this is a great starting point. Can you tell us, do you have a website or books that you've written or podcasts that you do that people can follow up?
Yes, I do. Our website is marklangley.com.au. All the information about what I do is on the website. You can also go on Facebook and look up Mark Langley Horsemanship. So it's marklangleyhorsemanship.com.au. Yeah, and there's the Facebook site. There's also videos on YouTube. They date back a long way. So some people in those YouTube, free YouTube videos, you'll see some of the, you know, different evolutions in things. And not that there was a big change in everything I've done. It's just you know, you see some old stuff, some new stuff. It's all out there and available. There's certainly mm-hmm. that free stuff. There's also stuff we offer, you know, through the website, like subscription stuff where you can just subscribe. You get your new monthly videos. You get your question and answer. So people can contact or send us through questions and we'll answer them every month and they go on a podcast, which Jenny and I do. And people can send me, you know, videos through the subscription that I'll just do a talk over on, which is a free thing in the subscription. Once you're on the subscription, you can send a video, like a 10-minute video, and I'll do a talk over. People can sort of, you know, then they got a bit of feedback from me after I've watched their videos and stuff.
The other thing is our very remote farm is the yes. first stop of Mark's U.S. tour for this year. So he is on his way to Kentucky.
Kentucky.
He'll be in Idaho, Minnesota, and then he's going to the Western States Horse Expo?
Yeah, the Western States Horse Expo. One of the
in California.
Yeah, the one of the presenters there for the, I guess, the horse training side of the expo. So
people can try and get a hold. They can catch up to him in person if they want to. And the schedule is on his website. I checked this
Super.
Morning. His wife's really good with that stuff.
I'm amazing at it too.
No, you're not.
Well, if anyone thank you for sharing with us today. And thank you, Stephanie, for taking time out of the clinic for us as well.
Well, it was a good thing that we did it this morning because, you know, Jenny said at night after a clinic day, he can be a little tired. And then both of us last night were totally clinic hungover. So
I'm sure
we got the bright shiny version of him.
Oh, no, I'm always
bright shiny. We appreciate the bright shiny.
No. Thanks, Aviva and Stephanie. I really appreciate it. And it's good to sort of help. Sometimes people in the dressage world don't necessarily the ones who do reach out to me go, oh, and you know, I've helped some horses, you know, pre-St. George horses and competitive riders who have really been struggling with their horses' anxiety, and then all of a sudden their movements get better and they get a lot softer, and it's such a pleasure to watch. And so it's just because I wear a hat and I've got a funny accent, or I believe that there is help there for people. And yeah, and thank you very much for having me on board, and I really appreciate it.
We know the accent actually makes it more worthwhile, don't we?
Well, thank you, Mark. And I think what's really important is knowing, I think that being open to learning and knowing that there isn't just one way to do things and being willing to listen to different approaches, that only makes things better. Yeah. Being in a tunnel and going down the tunnel, I mean, it's sort of like what you said with the nervous horse going into the valley of death. As long as the tunnel is there supporting your straight line, you do it. But if you take the tunnel away and throw the reins away, there's no direction anymore. And I think that being willing to look at other ways of looking at things gives you new directions. So thank you.
Yeah. That's completely right. But I think that the hardest thing though, is sometimes people like one tunnel because it makes it easy. And then when you create a whole bunch of tunnels, then you get that rabbit warren effect. So I can see people with a lot of information out there getting very, very confused. But I think that having a filter to know how these things, like Stephanie said before, how there's lots of similarities in the other mentors that you guys to some of the stuff that I was doing, there is a common denominator in there. And I think, but being a bit more open to, there could be a similar idea out there, but maybe a different way of taking it on board might be better for your horse. But I do see a lot of people that actually have too many tunnels available or too many options. Mm-hmm. And they're so confused because they've only gone down each one a tiny bit and never understood them.
Yeah.
And so there's risk in having tunnel vision and there's risk of being in a rabbit warren. So it's trying to, you know,
find that balance. We're all about the balance.
Yes, we are.
Mark, thank you.
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed it. And maybe we'll do it again someday. Yeah.